This is the NFL podcast, but great news, loyal listeners. We finally have decided on a name, one that we're not quite sure is going to stick, but we're going to go with it for now. This will begin to be called the Bet the Board podcast moving forward. Payne, are you in agreement that you can get on board with our new nomenclature for our football pod?
Nomenclature? Is that what you just said? Is that what you just broke out?
I know it's a big word for a Florida State guy. It's called nomenclature is the word. You got your internet in front of you. I'll let you Google it by the end of the podcast. We can let you give the full definition for our loyal listeners if you're still confused.
I'm good with the name.
All right, well, that's what we'll go with, and I'd like to give a shout-out to the folks that have listened already that are clamoring for the pod each Monday and Thursday. We're doing our best to give you all the top betting information, hopefully to get you guys to the window, and more importantly, Payne, hopefully they were able to capitalize on our strong leans on Baltimore and Dallas the last couple days.
Yeah, absolutely. We love those two sides. Dallas won the game outright Thursday night. Great way to start off the week with a pretty easy winner with the Baltimore Ravens over Pittsburgh Steelers, and I think we can probably find a few leans this week or get some sides that we like that we think the number is going to move in our direction in favor and get that out to the listeners.
Well, and before we even get into week three, of course, as is our Monday custom, we'll take a look at the Monday night game. And this is a fascinating game on so many levels. Indianapolis, a three-point favorite right now. Total, let's call it consensus, 53 at this point. Did open up at 2.5 with some juice and some shops. This number, and you brought the point up, you saw it even go to a 3.5 at one point before there was buyback on the underdog.
Yeah, early in the week, we saw Indianapolis, 2.5-point favorite. Some bettors got out ahead of the market. Three is that key number in the NFL. It got out as high as 3.5 at one book out in Vegas at the LVH, a book that most people consider very, very sharp, so that was interesting to see. We do know there's been some buyback on the Philadelphia Eagles, so it will be interesting to see where this number closes. Pinnacle, if any indication, this has a chance to close 2.5. We know both teams are banged up. Indianapolis on the defensive side of the ball, Philadelphia on the offensive side of the ball with 4 of 7 linemen out, so this will be a real interesting game this evening to watch.
And when you talk about this game, I mean, so much is made of Andrew Luck and the way he's bounced back off of losses in the past in his career. But he really is the only, let's call it, elite-level talent probably anywhere on that Colts roster. And when you see him laying 3 points in this particular spot against an Eagles team with so many weapons on a faster track, is that the kind of play that becomes, it gives you enough driving force to really get yourself behind Andrew Luck in a primetime spot to see if they can bounce back from their loss last Sunday against the Denver Broncos?
You know, it does scare me a little bit when you look at this number, when you see where the market's headed, but from day one, not a lot of people have liked the Colts, even with Andrew Luck. This is a team with, you know, you name, not a lot of talent around them. The offense does have some weapons, and I think they get a little more acclimated to the system this season. The running game will be a little better. But when you talk about the market, when you talk about sharp bettors that we speak to, they haven't liked Andrew Luck's version of the Colts in forever, and all he's done is cover spreads, 23-13 ATS since Luck's been the quarterback there. So it's something you really have to look at. No one's really liked the Colts, but I think if ever there was a spot, and when you look at this, I know Philadelphia struggled, but they still covered the number, and that's what's in bettors' minds. And most people fell asleep at halftime of the Sunday night game where they were down 24-0. So you could see a little bit of that in. My lean would be, I think you could probably look towards the Colts, especially early in the week when it was 2.5.
Yeah, I think it's 3. I mean, my inclination would be, and it's a game that I probably won't invest in myself, would be to take the 3 in this particular spot. And then the point you make about Andrew Luck, spot on, talking about how some of the sharper groups out there really haven't valued his performance, mainly because they don't see the supporting cast. And not to go off on a tangent, but it reminds me a lot of a pitcher in baseball who everyone expects to continually regress, and he goes out there start after start and continues to put up numbers. This past season, a guy that you and I spoke about at great lengths, Chris Young for the Seattle Mariners. How many times we tried to bet against him, and each time it seemed 6 innings, 2 earned runs, the bullpen came in and bailed him out, and no matter what the prices were, what the line move said, he would get you to the window when you backed him those games he was on the mound.
Yeah, absolutely. Very similar situation here, and I think everyone has a good supporting cast when you talk about the elite quarterbacks, but for me, if you were to put Andrew Luck on any of those other teams, I think they'd be more successful. He does more with a lot less. I think he's one of the best quarterbacks, if not the best quarterback in the NFL. Just a couple of weapons and not much else. The defense is an absolute train wreck. But that being said, I think when you look at this game, and we've already started to see it a little bit, this number got as high as 54, the total. People thinking two dynamic offenses, a fast service, which I get. But I think we'll see this game go under, closer to kickoff with a lot of professionals coming in on the under in this game.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. I think you'll see the recurational books sit around that 53 and a half, while the sharper shops probably down to 52. And as we talk about this, I will say one other thing, and we'll kind of leave it on this note. I think the team that comes out of this game victorious will be a prime fade candidate next week. Indy on the road at Jacksonville, and Philadelphia playing host to Washington, a game that could really give one of those teams a leg up in the much maligned NFC East at this point. But before we get into that, Payne, let's discuss what we saw yesterday in the wonderful world of the NFL. What were some of the major surprises, at least from your perspective, maybe as far as final scores and what you dug into in the box scores for your first cursory glance?
Yeah, I know we talked about this, and I think what I was more surprised about won't necessarily surprise people. When you know the guys that were on some of the games and you know where the lines went, I was very surprised with the Minnesota-New England final score. I know a lot of people said, you know, Brady, Belichick, they're not going to start 0-2. But when you see a game that was at 6, 6.5, just absolutely get buried by the professionals all the way down to 3, you know, you don't expect the blowout. One other game that was pretty shocking to me, and again, some of the professional bettors were on the Oakland Raiders. That team, just a dumpster fire. So I was surprised, because I'm not high on Houston, to see Houston travel across the country and just lay one on the Raiders. That Raiders team, my God, if there was relegation in the NFL, you'd see them head across the border to Canada next season.
Would definitely be interesting. That voice you're hearing, by the way, listeners, is that of Payne Insider. You can find his work at PayneInsider.com and follow him on Twitter at the exact same name. I'm your host, Todd Furman. And Payne, you mentioned that Minnesota-New England game, but I think what most of the bettors will be a little bit confused by when they see the final score look like complete domination. And I'm not going to defend Minnesota by any stretch. Matt Castle was downright awful. Seemed like the Patriots win their head. But we talk all the time about every NFL game having 2 or 3 plays that really decide an outcome. That game was amazing. It was 17-7. Minnesota was kind of back on their heels. Did have a chance to trim that deficit to a one-possession game, making it 17-10. Lo and behold, Blair Walsh's field goal gets blocked at the end of the half, and a game that should have had Minnesota down by only a touchdown goes into the half down 17. And as we know with this Vikings offense, not exactly built to come from behind, especially a 3-score game against a team as talented as the Patriots.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. Chandler Jones, big play to end the half. And that's the biggest score in all of the NFL. I truly believe that momentum touchdown going into halftime, it just seems like one team goes into the locker room just ready to tear down walls, and the other team walks into the locker room head down. We saw that similar situation on the Sunday night football game where the Bears looked like they were left for dead. Late touchdown grab, miracle grab by Brandon Marshall there, and they come out of the second half just rearing and firing and go.
Perfect segue to a game I definitely wanted to address, and I'll get back to the Raiders and their ineptitude, because I think right now you look at a team like Oakland along with the New York Giants, and you hate to say a team is unbettable, because obviously the number is the great equalizer, but from watching those two teams' performances, definitely some major issues there. But you talk about this Bears-49ers game. San Francisco up 17-0. Looked like they were in firm command of that particular football game. Lo and behold, the Bears get that touchdown going into the half. Second half number 2.5, soft 3, widely available, and it gives you an indication of exactly how momentum had changed. What did we learn about these two teams last night? The box score still shows domination by San Francisco, 361 to 216 as far as total yards are concerned. Obviously, penalties, the 49ers 16 for 118 won't get it done. But of course, as we know in the NFL, you're not going to win a whole lot of football games, especially as a touchdown favorite, when you end up -4 in the turnover department.
Yeah, I think you touched on everything. I know when I looked at this game, watched it, and then go back and look at the box score, I'm still scratching my head. You definitely have to tip your cap to Chicago. They went out and made the plays. You talk about two wide receivers potentially playing at about 70%. They were just out there gutting it out, got the win. But when I really break down this game, you nailed it. It was domination. I think Bears had 9 or 10 lives in the first half. That game could have easily been 28-0. You got a guy who doesn't fall on the ball. A couple turnovers, a blocking call on Anquan Boldin that, you know, isn't going to be called most likely on Frank Gore's touchdown very often. So they had those issues. Obviously, turnovers are going to kill you. 4 big turnovers for Kaepernick, including a fumble. And then you talk about when you break down these box scores and look at some of the numbers, and you nailed it, outgaining Chicago 361 to 216. But then you factor in 120 yards and penalties, and you're right where you need to be for an even game, and that's what we saw. The Bears made plays late. San Francisco, the opposite of that, turned it over, kicked themselves in the butt, and Chicago gets out of there with a win. But I think we talked about it a long time ago. We're not sold on San Francisco's defense. They're getting older. They can't get a pass rush. The secondary is very weak. So it'll be interesting to see moving forward. Maybe that changes when they get Aldon Smith back and Navarro Bowman.
Yeah, I'm definitely curious to see how San Francisco responds after a loss. I mean, that's really been their trademark under Coach Harbaugh, that the defense clamps down. I'm just not sure they're able to do so with so many holes in that defensive side of the ball and a huge divisional game coming up this weekend against the 2-0 Arizona team, who has a chance to get a two-game lead on the 49ers in that particular division. As far as surprises, I guess, from my end, you look up and down the board, and I know you and I talked about this before we even jumped on the podcast. I think the things that surprise the general public don't surprise us, who are so immersed in this business. And the one score that, of course, ESPN starts talking about it all day today, are the Seahawks done? I don't find that result against the Chargers all that surprising when you consider the amount of money that came in on San Diego in that spot, driving the number from 6 to 4 before there was a little bit of public support for the favorite pushing that number back up.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think that's a side that a lot of professionals were looking to. A lot of people talked about the short week and the extended rest for Seattle, but really when you talk about San Diego, Arizona to back home, not that big of a deal. They couldn't start the season 0-2. They really dominated that game, and again, not a surprise. We know where the money was at. We know what sides we were betting. We were all over the Chargers on that game. And really, I don't think that game was even nearly that close. Percy Harvin's touchdown, obviously that should have been disallowed. I'm not sure what they saw there in New York on the review. But
probably not game, much, judging game, by the fact that we saw it.
Yeah, absolutely. That game really wasn't even that close, 30-21 final score. They dominated virtually the entire game, kept Seattle's offense off the field. But, you know, you nailed it. ESPN all day long now talking about, is Seattle's reign done? And it'll be an interesting segue when we talk about the big game next week, Denver versus Seattle.
Yeah, it's definitely a game we'll cover in greater detail on Thursday, so encourage listeners, not like they wouldn't anyways, but to make sure that when we give our in-depth breakdowns later in the week, you talked about time of possession. 42 minutes in that game for the Chargers, only a little less than 18 for the Seahawks. And another game, I guess, you know, a team that the Seahawks will be playing next week in Denver, they were dominated in the time of possession category as well. Alex Smith in Kansas City, they get full marks from me for their performance, bouncing back off of the loss in a game they looked outclassed against the Titans, doing what they needed to keep Denver's high-powered offense on the sidelines for a large part in the second half, actually outscoring the Broncos 7-3 and winning the time of possession battle 36 minutes to 23.
Yeah, it was a great game. I was really, really pleased with Alex Smith, how he performed there. I thought he kept them in the game, made plays with his feet when he had to, found some open receivers. That was a game where they, I thought, dominated the second half. Obviously, they don't score touchdowns on that big 10-minute drive to open the half. They botch a 37-yard field goal, and you're thinking, okay, here the doors are going to get blown off. But they did a valiant job on defense, despite no Eric Berry, all the injuries going into the game. And then you lose Jamal Charles, which I think a lot of people, you know, in their fantasy days, and they'll look at it and say, oh, my God, they lost Jamal Charles. Niles Davis is a more than capable backup, and he would start, I would say, for two-thirds of the NFL right now at running back. He's that good. So I didn't see that being a major drop-off. But they had a chance late in that game not only to be competitive but tie it up and send it into overtime.
It really was amazing how they battled. And Denver, of course, you can't really fault them for not being entirely focused on that particular game. They did what they needed to. They got a win within the division, and we talk about it all the time. When you're laying double digits in the NFL, you need a team to be nearly perfect. There's not that much of a talent gap between them. Of course, those sentiments may not apply to the Raiders and Giants, but that's a whole different topic. A handful of other teams that I was curious to get your thoughts on, I'll just throw them out there. If you have something, great. If not, we can pass through them. Talk about the Dolphins, Bills, Cowboys, Titans, and of course the team that everybody probably prematurely hitting the panic button on, the New Orleans Saints.
Well, it seems like you hit the panic button on the Giants, and I think that's going to be a side that you'll look at this weekend. But when I look at
we know you love to back bad teams. Trust me, I do as well, and I think Houston is another bottom feeder. But I would agree if this number got to a 3, I could make the case for the Giants. But I didn't mean to cut you off.
When you took a look at all those teams, I think the Dolphins are a team that we're going to find a lot out about them this week. We are. And right now what we saw in week one was a dominant performance. They laid a goose egg up in Buffalo, a spot where they do not play well. It's just a bad matchup. There are a few teams that are more physical than Miami, and Buffalo is one of those teams. And when they play them, it is just a bad matchup. There are some injury issues on this team, and we saw them full force this past weekend. They are without three of their top linebackers. So what they've had to do is move guys like Jason Trusnik, who is their special teams captain, and stand out and play him at middle linebacker. And because of that, they didn't use him on special teams. What did we see? A blocked punt, 102-yard kickoff return. So those are some questions for Miami. And the big, big loss is no Sean Moreno with the elbow issue. This is a guy who I thought was a product of a system, but when he came into Miami, he was a little overweight. Despite that, was still the best option at running back, and Lamar Miller is just not that guy. This offense needs a running game, and I think they might be in trouble long term if no Sean Moreno is not their running back.
Come on, No'Shawn, get out there and tape that elbow up. I mean, that thing didn't look that bad on the injury. Honestly, one of the more gruesome injuries we saw the entire day, when him putting that down on the turf and getting rolled into by a linebacker. But, you know, worst case scenario, Payne, I mean, Daniel Thomas is always available. I'm sure you guys could go out there and scoop him up to bolster that Dolphins running game if need be.
K-State's finest. But I think you nailed it, and I think a lot of people we'll look at this game and we see two starting running backs out and they'll think, oh my God, Jamal Charles, and they won't even talk about no Sean Moreno. I'm looking around the league. No one's even really mentioned no Sean Moreno being out, and the downgrade from no Sean Moreno to Lamar Miller is far, far bigger than Jamal Charles to Niles Davis.
Before we get into injuries, and that's probably be what we close with, the last team I was interested to get your take on, you know, what do you make of the Saints through the first two games? Of course, we saw money coming on the Browns. We know New Orleans, not the same team when they travel, especially playing on natural grass. Is it time to panic for New Orleans? Obviously, I mean, it looks like they have a game they can get healthy with against the Vikings this week, but this something's got to change for this team if they're going to be considered elite, especially when they go on the road.
Well, I think the first two games prove that they're not elite. You know, we wanted to make them elite, and we said, hey, if you can go win these two road games away from your comfort zone, away from home, you know, then you got a great shot to win the Super Bowl, and they haven't been able to do that. That said, they're one or two plays in the fourth quarter away from being 2-0. That being said, though, right now they still have eight home games, and that's they just don't lose there. So if they handle business at home, they're going to be right in the mix in this division, and I think moving forward, the offense will get a little more acclimated with some new pieces. I know Ingram goes down, but I think they'll be fine. Win your games at home, and I think the rest will play out. They're still a tough team. What I'm watching on them is Drew Brees. Has he regressed? We saw last year in the playoff game against Philadelphia. Doesn't seem to have the arm strength he once had, and that's a concern. Another pick six this past week. So that's really where this team, and I'm trying to monitor, is Drew Brees. How much has he regressed? And I think that's something everyone should look at.
It should definitely be a team to keep our eye on, because if Brees can't move this team up and down the field, the defense clearly indicated through the first 2 weeks they're not good enough, despite some, you know, fortifications there during the offseason to try and win games 20-17. As you talk about that playoff game, you figured, all right, maybe the Saints had turned the corner a bit, going on the road, winning in hostile territory. But, of course, as the regular season started, same old Saints when they leave the confines of the Superdome. We hit a little bit on injuries, and this is probably a question that a number of people have as far as valuation. I know we talked about Cam on the last podcast and what he meant to Carolina. But as far as players that don't impact the point spreads, how do you go about trying to adjust, you know, your power potential? I mean, you mentioned no Sean Moreno, Mark Ingram down. We saw a major move on the Panthers-Lions game as well, with Greg Hardy being deactivated. You know, how do you go about properly valuing these players? Or are there some guys that, you know, definitely move the needle, and some guys that you go, I really don't care if they dress or they're even out there to try and contribute?
Yeah, it's definitely tough, and I think we saw the perfect storm there with you know, Greg Hardy and that issue. There were sharp guys already on the Lions. As soon as he went out, that just compounded that move. It was a mixture of not feeling like Cam Newton was going to be 100% healthy. And then also, you know, the wise guys do not like Carolina this year, for whatever reason that is. So that was kind of the perfect storm, so I don't want to use that. I think that was more of an outlier. But when you factor in, we touched on this last week, what's the replacement value? You know, everyone, again, we'll talk about Jamal Charles going down, but Niles Davis, I think, could start for 2/3 of the league. So I don't think there's a massive drop-off there. So that's the key, finding out what the drop-off is, finding out what the system is. I don't think Ingram in New Orleans will be a big loss based upon how that system's run. It's been a plug-and-play at running back for as long as I can remember. So I don't think that's going to be a big injury moving forward. So those are the kinds of things you need to look at: schematics, schemes, the replacement players, and things of that nature, to kind of gauge how much you should be assessing for players going down or being suspended.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those metrics that we've grown accustomed to using in baseball when we talk about WAR, wins above replacement. And it's not quite the same concept, but a lot of similarities and parallels created in terms of figuring out what that depth is like. People ask all the time, you know, what is player A worth? Well, it's not just what player A is worth, as you alluded to. It's what's the scheme? What's the other talent? Do I have a guy that can step in and play, you know, extremely well? As we saw with the Rams, you know, this number actually came down when Austin Davis was announced as a starter against Sean Hill, and that was as much the way their defense played, some of the issues that Tampa had. And I think the one piece that people fail to realize is how much the opponent actually plays into the equation. There are matchups where a quarterback's absence could be worth 8 points. There are other matchups where the exact same guy is actually only worth 4.
Yeah, you nailed it. You definitely have to look at the matchup. We again talked about that last week with offensive linemen. If they're going to a place in a hostile environment with a good defensive line, that's going to be far different than maybe against playing the Colts. You know, tonight it's a perfect example with Philadelphia being out 4 of their top 7 linemen. So can Indianapolis kind of take that and use it? But some teams might not be able to capitalize on that. So that's definitely something that you need to look at. And again, I think some of these moves, when you talk about the Bucs game, that was kind of a perfect storm. A lot of sharp guys were on the Rams regardless of who started at quarterback. And I think the biggest thing there was fading Lovie Smith. That guy just seems completely inept, and it seems like the game's passed him by.
Well, I mean, Bears fans were not exactly sad to see him leave the confines of Soldier Field, so that's for sure. And Payne, as we did last Monday, we're going to do it again. Bust out that crystal ball. Which are some of the games that our listeners should be paying attention to, trying to figure out if they need to go early on particular sides or totals, or maybe wait it out and try and get a better number later in the week?
I think we talked about it a little earlier. I know you're down on the Giants, and again, they look very inept. Second half, that was a game that they looked like they had all the momentum up 14-10. Just some bad plays and some brain farts there. A couple drops from a guy like Cruz, who has kind of noted himself in the public and the press, said, "Get me the ball," and he had 3 drops on crucial drives. But that game opened 3. I think this is a game that potentially still has value. I wouldn't be shocked to see this game close a pick, or maybe even the Giants favored by 1. So I think that's a game that's going to move. And I think this Seattle-Denver, which we'll hit on more on the Thursday podcast, I wouldn't be so sure to sell Seattle at this point. I think it's a good matchup with Denver. So I think those are 2 games that you look on, and you'll see some significant line move when it goes to close on Sunday.
I'll add one other game to that mix. I think the side in total in Tennessee-Cincinnati should be fascinating. You've seen the total open 44, actually down to 43.5. Of course, the big injury concern for Cincinnati is A.J. Green. Don't be confused by that 24-10 score we saw against Atlanta. That was a byproduct of Cincy imposing their will at the line of scrimmage. I'm not sure they'll have that same luxury. And really don't anticipate Cincinnati having the same level of focus, knowing that they were able to start the season 2-0 in this particular spot. I mean, have to be feeling excited about themselves. And they head into a bye week for week 4. So you don't think that we're going to see a max effort from them. I will say, though, to the Bengals' credit, that now makes them 9 straight wins at home, 9 straight covers during regular season games. So clearly one of those home field advantages that maybe is being a little bit undervalued by odds makers out there.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. That is one of the bigger home field advantages. And I think it even gets bigger later in the season with the weather. Obviously not so much in division games, but I think when you get those non-conference opponents, you definitely look towards Cincinnati in that weather. You get a dome team. That was interesting to me, was Atlanta. I know they're a dome team, but they were fortunate to catch Cincinnati early on in the schedule, but that just didn't matter. Cincinnati owned and dominated at home, as they usually do, and I'm shocked we haven't seen a massive regression from that defense with Zimmer now in Minnesota.
Yeah, you have to wonder if over the course of the season, if they were to lose key personnel, how that things would change there. Of course, you know, every week you try and figure out, every week removed from some of these talented coordinators, bad habits start to form and things start to change a little bit. But I'm going to give you a chance for last word, Payne. Any parting shots before we leave our loyal listenership until we reconvene this coming Thursday?
I'm going to be busy right now Googling that massive word you used at the beginning of this podcast. Other than that, that's about it. And I know we'll be ready to go Thursday.
I will fire you a text with the correct spelling so you can bust out your Webster's Dictionary. You can check Google, the thesaurus, and whatever other tools you'd like to use. But for Payne Insider, who you can find on Twitter at Payne Insider or PayneInsider.com, I'm your host, Todd Furman. Follow me on Twitter as well, Todd Furman. This has been Bet the Board Monday podcast as we preview the lines, some of the movers, and, of course, the big Monday night game later this evening between the Colts and Eagles.